then you come back to Oklahoma, and you live in a home near Claremore because you joined the law firm of Hall Estill in 1978. What kind of work did you do there?
Well, I worked for the Williams Company. Joe Williams was the chief executive officer of the Hall Estill law firm, and they were involved in a lot of antitrust litigation and all that sort of thing. Fred Nelson, who had recovered, was one of the senior partners in that firm. They were the ones that were primarily responsible for getting me. I wanted to come back to Oklahoma, but I didn't know what I was going to do. And I made it clear to them that I hoped to get a federal judicial appointment, and that would be one of my aims. So primarily what I did was represent the Williams companies. I did do a little work for Eastern Airlines, but not very much. Eastern Airlines is a client, but I didn't represent hardly any of them. None of the other people that we'd previously regulated did that for 19 months, during which time this vacancy occurred and they had commissions to appoint several positions. There are four on a federal trial bench and one on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals position.
That was kind of almost a perfect storm there for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
By the way, some of the lawyers that you worked with at Hall Estill, do you recall some of those names?
Oh, yeah. Tom Golden, Frank Hagedorn, Claire Egan, who is the federal judge over in Tulsa now. She was with the firm. Tom Gable.
So Senator Bourne was a senior Democrat senator from Oklahoma, even though he'd been newly elected.
Yes.
He was a senior Democrat, and this would be under President Jimmy Carter. Then that's when you come along with others like Thomas Brett.
Tom Brett, Tulsa.
James Ellison.
Tulsa.
And District Judge Frank Say of Seminole.
Seminole.
All those names, including Stephanie Seymour for the 10th Circuit Court, that Senator Bourne, under President Carter, is able to make all those appointments. That was a pretty big deal.
That was a huge deal. He says that he recognized that as perhaps the most significant thing, his appointments to the federal bench, and particularly that many. At that time, the White House controlled the circuit appointments a good bit more than they did the district court position. But one of the difficulties that we encountered as a group is that we were all four white-eyed guys, and Stephanie was a woman. Stephanie was appropriately appointed to the 10th Circuit, but there was some concern in the White House that they needed more diversity. And so we had that struggle. Senator Bourne was, I don't want to put the onus on him, but he was extremely influential in that, getting the four of us appointed as opposed to someone else.
And your district was covering all of Western Oklahoma.
Western Oklahoma.
What are some of the differences between state and federal court?
Well, there are a number. The most significant is that the federal appointment is a lifetime appointment during good behavior, and that's extremely important because having served both, I can tell you, it's not a healthy thing to be looking over your shoulder at every single decision as to how popular or unpopular it will be at the moment. Yeah, I mean, there's just a good deal more security when you can look at it and say, well, this may not be the right decision. I think it is. But the fact that a lot of people are terribly upset with it at the present time or somewhat upset with it is not going to get me kicked out of office. And believe me, anybody will tell you that is a significant comforting feeling as a judge. And I think it's a very important thing, that independence of the judiciary. The other is there's more security financially, not only just for the lifetime appointment, but the pay and the benefits. But the biggest difference is the staffing that you have as a federal judge. Although it's not large, I have two outstanding law clerks, an outstanding secretary, and a court reporter and a courtroom deputy as a state court judge. And even when I was on the Supreme Court by special appointment, you don't have any of that. You're out there doing all the research yourself, drafting all the opinions. I've always tried to hire law clerks, and have, that were a hell of a lot smarter than I am and with more ability than I have. I've been very successful at that, and they can be an enormous assistance to you.
You had a full load, and you had a backup of trial cases. But you devised a plan to settle these cases before coming to trial, settlement conferences.
Tom Brett and I, I got to give him a good bit of credit. We were the first ones that implemented it over here. But when I came on board, we were trying 16% of the cases that were filed, civil cases I'm talking about. That was a good bit higher than the national average, which was 9%. Judge Luther Eubanks was our chief judge then, and after looking at this, I was trying two cases a day and all that sort of thing, trying to reduce that backlog, working enormously hard, killing my staff and everything. But I went to him and I said, you know, we're not settling as many of these cases as they do on the national level. Something's wrong with our system. That prompted him to say, yeah, figure out why and let's change. Tom and I talked, and we got the idea from a fellow up in Ohio by the name of Tom Lambros, who we knew at a judicial conference, of having kind of a briefed advisory opinion affecting jurors that would allow jurors to indicate to the parties the merits of their case without going through a long 8 or 10 week trial. It's called a summary jury trial. We set it up down here. What it amounted to is a trial, except you don't present detailed evidence. You allow the attorneys to summarize what their evidence is. As an officer of the court, they have to assure the court that the evidence is available for whatever they say. But we allow them to summarize their case, then make arguments, and we instruct the jury just as we would in a regular case. All of that can be done in 1 or maybe 2 days. And then when the jury returns a verdict, it's merely advisory. It is not binding on the parties, but it gives them some idea. It worked amazingly well. We went from settling 84% of our cases to settling 94% almost in a year or two. Then it finally got up where it is now, 98%. Most of the cases are compromised and settled. Now, that's because of some help and encouragement we give, but it's also because it's gotten so terribly expensive to litigate that the parties are more and more reaching what we call alternative dispute resolution techniques, mediation, and that sort of thing.
So you gained a reputation for settling cases, as in the case of a New York insurance company and a severe injury case that was scheduled for a week-long trial. The company had not paid the million-dollar limit policy?
Oh, yeah. It was a case where liability was very clear, and all the parties admitted it. They were simply holding out, and after getting together with the attorneys at a settlement conference, I became convinced that they should pay the policy limits and probably would get stuck for a good bit more if they didn't pay this $1 million. So I called, got in touch with the executive himself, talked with him, and after visiting with him not a very long period of time, he said, where do you want me to send this $1 million check?
Man, it just took a 5-minute phone call, maybe, it could have been a long
saved trial. A lot of money. They'd have spent a terrible amount of that money on the trial itself.